Hello and welcome back to our podcast for the NATO Association of Canada, where we're talking about changes to the global economy. If you listened to the first part of our podcast, which is linked below, on the responses of the international business and economics researchers to the question of different changes in the global economy, you'll notice a few different major trends that we're going to discuss in more detail in a conversation now. First, I wanted to touch on the theme of openness, how openness is interpreted by different societies, and how, I guess, social issues of immigration and identity are affecting economic capacities in different countries in light of lots of different elections, for example, of leaders that are not open to immigration and not open to trade and not open to a globally interconnected world. So we'll discuss things like ethno-nationalism, the benefits and disadvantages of openness on economic terms, and the legitimacy of the global economic system. Second, another big theme was social factors of change, such as innovation, new industries popping up, especially the digital economy, changes of demographics and how different countries are able to deal with them, and institutional capacities, how countries can react to changes. And third and finally, geopolitical events and trends. So there were some really good points brought up by our contributors about, for example, US relying on certain allies for political stability in different regions of the world in order to secure different interests, such as China containing North Korea, or you know, the US strategy of using Saudi Arabia to control oil prices. So all of that and more will be discussed now. I'm going to open it up to the first theme, which is openness, if anybody wants to respond first.
I can address openness to kick it off, I guess. So to me, when I'm thinking about Fukuyamism and the challenges to Fukuyamism, namely, as I mentioned in the first segment, about how many of the challenges to that idea come in the form of illiberal movements, illiberal democracy that retain elections and stuff like this, but not, they dispense with the liberal part. And for those who don't know what the liberalism is all about at its core, it's based on the pillars of pluralism, tolerating values under a certain acceptable range, and equality under the rule of law. And these illiberal movements are defining the nation state in terms of an ethno-national identity rather than the multinational state that we take for granted in Canada, for example. But even here, there's tension beginning to arise, as we can see in some of the rhetoric from people running for office. But the reason this is important is because when it comes to openness, right, the whole idea of free movement of capital and ideas and trade.
And labor.
Yes, absolutely. People, exactly. Like, take the European Union, for example. There's a pretty inherent contradiction in some of these far-right parties' platforms of closing the borders to immigration, because as Ross is going to elaborate on, I'm sure, much of the developed world, the industrialized countries of the world, in Europe in particular, are facing coming demographic catastrophes in a way, because their populations are aging, and it's going to be very difficult to maintain welfare states when your tax rates is reduced and people are demanding more in terms of pensions and stuff like that, entitlement programs. And when you clamp down on immigration, it's impossible to replenish and refresh the demographic balance in terms of the age share. And that's the only way, because the replacement rate is too low, as Ross mentioned. So it's difficult to see how they're going to reconcile those two realities. Something has to give.
Okay, well, one thing that I want to bring to attention, perhaps this is devil's advocate, there's a lot of scholarly and general understanding that Europe has always, to some degree, had this ethno-national trend to it, much more so than Canada and US, as you mentioned, especially kind of the Canadian multicultural experiment. But then my question is, if immigration is being disavowed by all these different parties like the National Front in France or the AFD in Germany, what does that say about whether or not what we're seeing now in Europe is not necessarily a resurgence of ethnic identity as much as it is a disavowal of the liberal state as you defined it. Obviously, the two are related, but, like, you know, there are some eerie similarities between now and the first few decades of the 20th century, where there was rife suspicion of ethnic minorities who they perceived to be damaging the prosperity of European civilization. You know, and back then it was the Jewish people, now more it's the Muslim people and generally other immigrants who are coming and taking our jobs, quote unquote. So I just wanted to unpack that a little bit.
Well, is it a certain, is one way of sort of framing that the idea that to an extent the post-war liberal state managed to patch paper over the ethnic divisions that have always existed in Europe, and now that the liberal state is failing to satisfy all its constituencies, those fissures are opening up again? Or are you more talking about the fact that, nah, Europeans have always been ethnic nationalists, it's just the liberal state is failing, and we have these challenges to liberalism cloaked in nationalist agendas?
I was gonna draw on a concept that came up in my research for my master's, which was like reactive ethnicity and reactive religiosity. And when you're in a context, when you're in a situation where, like, practicing your religion or being different, there are all these tropes around, they're stealing our jobs, these are the other. There's actually been research done that finds that third generation Muslims practice more authentically than their second gen parents or first gen counterparts, just because of this environment that they're in of being displaced and being considered the other. And so it kind of like gives them this authenticity of religious practice almost as in a reactive way. There's even with like race relations, and a lot of people of color are taking back the term race and want race included in the census instead of kind of couched in terms of ethnicity, because it erases a lot of the history and like the historical violence that came with racism in the beginning. But I don't know if that's what you're getting at, but that's what came to my mind.
Well, there definitely is the word reactive that you used, I think, is key, because a lot of the quote-unquote liberal elite uses this word very pejoratively, even if it is, I think, quite descriptive and accurate. And that's kind of the resurgence of not necessarily ethnic identities, but their importance in politics. And so when you get a group of people in society that appears to be different in their values than the dominant group, and that dominant group feels threatened by them, then they're, you know, it's typical behavior of blaming a lot of their problems on that group of people.
Yeah, on the other. It's interesting. I did a research project on refugee arrivals in Canada and did like a content analysis. And there were three frames that emerged, which were framing the refugees as a racial threat, a political threat, and an economic threat. And the political threat was the most prominent.
Yeah, that is really interesting. And on the flip side, too, it's almost, well, it's a trade-off. I mean, if you believe that, you know, that refugees or immigrants may be some kind of economic threat or, you know, quote unquote, stealing jobs or whatnot.
Yeah.
There's the flip side. If you know, like true white right-wing believers believe that there is no place for immigrants in a healthy economy, there's the flip side where, okay, well, what about trade? Are we going to just completely close the borders to trade? Well, then your economy is dead. Like, what are you going to trade within your people? I guess, but it's not sustainable. There's that where, you know, Trump right now or Brexit. I think Brexit is going to be end up being all right the way it looks, you know, with trade. But Trump right now is kind of still up in the air as far as like NAFTA. That's not been concreted yet. Still, there's apparently going to be tariffs added, or who knows what's going to happen. And the trade war, that too, like, again, that's not been concreted. And a trade war with China is going to completely change the world economic order right now. And so it's interesting, the kind of the balance between, okay, well, you want your economy to grow, but you want to close your borders. and limit your trade options, well, your economy won't grow.
So I wanted to refocus the conversation about examples of what someone mentioned about the legitimacy of this liberal world order that was created with the Bretton Woods institutions, and that's being maintained by Western acceptance of it and general global acceptance of it to some degree. For example, you are going to see if countries start pulling out of multilateral institutions, you are going to see much less funding and diplomatic attention go to international organizations, both in general and specifically on economic terms. You may see less funding for development assistance or more focused funding for development assistance that only hits niche types of projects and doesn't necessarily address structural issues in the economies of developing countries. You might see a every country for themselves mentality, where, as some of you have noted, you're going to have a trade-off between nationally focused economy that will aim to benefit citizens more, but you're going to have reduced capacity to export. You're going to have increased tariffs. A great example is the Turkish referendum. A lot of news has come out. I think there was an article I read either in the Brookings Institute or the European Council for Foreign Relations that said that Europe and Turkey are very much interlinked and they need each other. And to an extent, Turkey and the US need each other as well. And if Turkey goes down the same path of protectionism that is expected from right-wing, far-right populist nationalist leaders in Europe and the US, you're going to have a reduced export of steel, for example, which will hurt Turkey's GDP, and it'll also, you know, it'll also affect the market in the US. The EU is Turkey's largest trade partner, so any deals that are made or not made that will close the trade border will have huge impacts, especially considering that Russia is cooling down as a trading partner with Turkey. So that's just one example. You might have cancellation or renegotiations of free trade agreements, as people mentioned. If NAFTA cannot be made to suit the parties that are supposed to benefit from it, then it likely won't be scrapped or renegotiated because that requires political efforts. It might be easier, as someone said, to merely circumvent NAFTA, and Canada might go elsewhere to get a better deal, causing trade wars, causing other spats.
Well, I was going to touch upon openness in terms of immigration, and especially looking at Trump's immigrant ban and just the kind of hostility towards a lot of immigrants. So 40% of Fortune 500 companies were in fact founded by immigrants or children of immigrants. And so, like, I imagine in the short-term future, long-term future, just a huge brain drain when it comes to innovation as well as just technological disruption in the US. There is like a specific type of environment that is required for a lot of innovation. And we're seeing that the most innovative countries are producing the most kind of tax revenue for the particular economy. So with this immigration ban, I just see kind of a turn away from the US and a turn towards these better environments that foster innovation. I also imagine a brain drain in a lot of these countries that don't really foster this turn towards technology, regardless of whether you're an immigrant or not. So I don't know. Those are just my thoughts on that.
Yeah, that leads me to a really great example that I just thought of. There's this Japanese-American theoretical physicist. His name is Dr. Michio Kaku. He was one of the founders of string theory, and he speaks a lot about innovation and like scientific innovation and how it affects the American economy. He did a talk that I might be able to find a link for on YouTube where he mentioned that the vast majority of PhD candidates in top schools in the US in STEM backgrounds are foreign nationals. And the US is conscious of this and does this on purpose in order to maintain its lead in research and development. And now that economies in China and India are growing, a lot of top students in those countries are going to opt to stay at home instead of go to the US to study, which means they won't generate those high-paying jobs and won't generate that economic innovation in the U.S., which could have catastrophic consequences in the long term, according to Dr. Kaku. That's just one example of how the reduced flow of intellectual labor in this case would mm-hmm. affect the American economy. Ross, you had something to say.
Just a brief example that pretty much the same thing is happening in Britain as a result of Brexit. One of the government's new policies that it introduced in an effort to limit immigration was a proposed quota on the number of international students coming into Britain. International students are not only a massive source of revenue for British universities, but they contribute to a lot of the research that puts British universities at the top of the global research field. And those restrictions have been widely criticized by academics and parties within the British political system for precisely that reason, that not only does a restriction on intellectual immigration damage Britain's research standing, but it also has knock-off effects for the country's economy and for the institutions that it is supposed to be defending from immigration.
Mm-hmm. Brad?
So yeah, on the topic of openness and free flow of people and stuff over borders, I thought of something else about how, particularly as it pertains to the EU, it's useful to recall that the European Union's, like, the reason it was formed in the first place was basically as a response to World War II and to try and prevent conflict from ever happening again. Because the idea was that if you can integrate economies, it makes no sense to destroy your neighbor when you depend on them to be prosperous in order to be able to afford the products you're trying to sell to them.
For sure.
You need someone to export to. And in the absence of that integration, it renews the possibility for conflict, at least potentially. And our generation and our parents' generation have probably forgotten that because we haven't lived through a world war. But older generations who are nearing the end of their lives today, they would be fully attuned to that. But it's just a matter of recalling the lessons of the past, really.
Right. So what about the fact that that economic integration has been, there are criticisms on this from both the right and the left, that this economic integration has relied on inequality between the parties, which is one of the main thrusts of this rise in ethno-nationalism that you mentioned earlier. So for example, that because you mentioned the Golden Dawn, and Greece claims that Germany had used its clout in the European Central Bank and its own banking system to make sure that Greece does not develop its own economy, thereby making it dependent on the ECB and not being able to grow its economy, even though it was stuck in the Eurozone.
Yeah, I'm no expert on that, the dynamics of that, but it does seem like a bit of an exploitative situation, to be sure, the amount of debt that some of the, maybe you could call the periphery members of the EU have been saddled mm-hmm. with by the creditors that are France and Germany, primarily the linchpins of that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, we're going to end our discussion on openness here. Join us in the next part of our podcast, where we'll be talking about social factors of change, which is the next theme that our analysts have identified. We'll be talking about things such as demographics, innovation and a growing digital economy, and society's relationship with technology. All that and more. So thanks everybody for listening, and stay tuned.